Hey, resilient recruiters, here's reason number two why you must attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. And that is the keynote presentations. You'll gain exclusive insights from other top billing recruiters and entrepreneurs who've either scaled their own desk or built multi-seven-figure businesses. I myself will, of course, be one of the speakers, but the presentations that I am the most excited about are not professional speakers and trainers, but other recruitment business owners like you who will be unpacking their most effective tactics and strategies. No theory, just practical insights from people who are in the trenches, ordinary people achieving extraordinary results. There's still time to take advantage of the early bird pricing. By the way, it's happening on September 17th and 18th. So don't miss out. Reserve your place now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby. I'm delighted to be joined today by Mark Brown. Mark is the co-founder and director of Worldwide Recruitment Solutions, WRS. WRS is a global recruitment consultancy serving the oil and gas, mining, marine, and power industries. And according to Recruiter Magazine, they are the third fastest growing recruitment company in the UK. They've won a long list of awards, including Sunday Times Best Small Company to Work For. They've been placed on Virgin Fast Track list. They've also won the Queen's Award for Enterprise and International Trade, which is pretty cool. They have offices globally, UK, Singapore, Iraq, and Uganda. Revenues of £56 million. Mark himself has over 20 years experience as a recruitment owner and CEO. Mark, thanks for being here. I really am looking forward to this.
Hey, very welcome. Happy to join.
Fantastic. So 20 years of owning and running recruitment businesses. How did you get involved in the industry in the first place, Mark?
Oh, purely by chance. I'm sure a story that many recruiters could can associate with for sure. But yeah, look, I was in a non-related sector. I was at a time in my life and the world of call centers was very much my background. I had a former associate of mine who'd left that sector and spent 12 successful months in recruitment. That was in Dublin in Ireland, and he was relocating due to personal reasons, family member not being well. Reached out to me, sold me the dream, for want of a better word, that jumping into partnership. And look, Manchester at the time was a very hot region for contact center, and that was very much going to be our entrance into the market. We were going to be set up through our networks, lots of agreements in principle to provide and supply staff, given we've clearly been on the other side of the fence in terms of recruiting large volumes of people. And I guess that's where our experience had sat. And yeah, I took a leap of faith. You know, I just moved into a new house. Twin daughters were literally 3 months old when I made the plunge.
Oh,
so
wow.
When I say a leap of faith, it absolutely was one.
So wait a second. Let me just get this straight. So you worked in a call center.
That's right. Yeah. So call center management was
okay.
Yeah, that was the area I was working.
Got it. And then you had an associate friend who was setting up a recruitment business to serve call centers.
Correct.
Okay, got it. And they said you should come in and be part of this.
That's right, yeah. And just to be clear, it was literally the two of us. So we entered into it, limited liability company, 50-50 shareholders.
Yeah, wow.
took a bank managed to get a bank loan somehow to fund the startup, and you know, that was it. Literally day one away we went. Very simple infrastructure and a telephone.
Wow. So that's pretty bold, to because you had zero recruitment experience and your partner only had 12 months experience. So but you thought, you know, how hard can it be? We'll just, we can do this, and we've got the industry background. So good on you. That's a courageous, especially with like young twins at home. What did your partner think of this venture?
Oh, she thought I was nuts, but you know, we'd done the usual thing, setting up you sort of model out your numbers, what could it look like, and you know, you always start off with something that you know, in the cold light of day, was unrealistic given all the things that you'd mentioned and the lack of experience and otherwise. But hey, you know, you kind of only think the glass is half full when you're entering into those types of decisions. And yeah, it really, really was a leap of faith.
And how did it go?
Yeah, well, if I share with you that this was September the 1st, 2001, call centers, very much travel related. That was the marketplace that was the core of the population in Manchester for call centers. And lo and behold, 10 days later, September the 11th happened, which I do remember very, very well, watching it on the television in our very small serviced office in Altrincham. And yeah, needless to say, yeah, the business plan was ripped up 11 days in, and we were already in, oh my God, state as to what the hell are we going to do?
That's so interesting. You and I, Mark, started in business on the exact same day.
Wow.
I started this business, the recruitment coach business, in September 1st, 2001. And I had the same, like, that the whole world changed on September 11th. I remember seeing it on the television, and it just completely seemed unreal and sort of like, yeah. And so how did things progress from there?
Yeah, so we shift tax into and focus into generic sales. That for me, given the level of experience that I had, was incredibly difficult. If you can think of filters that you're looking for, yeah, you know, it was very obvious very, very quickly that we needed to determine a niche. And you know, people say you create your own luck, but by default or design, we stumbled across the world of finance, in particular within the mortgage marketplace. There was changes in regulation and requirements from a compliance perspective that they'd introduced a qualification that was called CMAP, so Certificate in Mortgage Advice and Practice. And firms were very much giving mandates out to recruiters that they wanted to see CVs and resumes of candidates who had a CMAP 1 qualification and or the equivalent, which was a financial planning certificate level 1. So that became just a great filter, because the only people we were searching for and or were keen to talk to were individuals who met that criteria. So it really did hone in and gave us an opportunity to really target our searches and identify people that you know, we could ultimately place and introduce to our client base.
Fantastic. And I'm guessing that worked better. How long did you do that for?
Yeah, so that business, under the guise of KCMB, which was no more innovative than the two initials of the two founders.
MB Mark Brown?
That's the one. yeah, so that business ran for 7 years, right up till 2008 is probably the best turning out of 2007 into 2008. We built a nice lifestyle business, as I would introduce it, almost exclusively perm, very much niched further down into the subprime world that was going through a real explosion during that that time. So our clients would have been the Merrill Lynch, the Morgan Stanley, the Bear Stearns, obviously their branded vehicles in the UK mortgage market. And yeah, as I say, we had a very good business, very, very niche, dominant within our market space. Very few competitors that were solely that. A lot of the bigger players would have a sector or a division that would focus on that. But we were probably one of a handful of standalone niche businesses focused exclusively on this sector. And yeah, up to 2008, fabulous. In fact, I would even say Q4 2007, we saw the GFC and the financial crisis coming, wouldn't say before anybody else, but we certainly knew about it before a lot of people because it wasn't in the mainstream till we turned into to Q1, Q2, 2008. And we had, for a business of our size, £100,000 worth of fee income taken off our order book that was due to start November, by virtue that literally these companies left the lights on, left the doors open, but they'd run for the hills. You know, we knew there was a problem. We really knew there was going to be a challenge to our niche.
Absolutely. Like, you were in probably the most affected area, which was property, mortgages, and everything else. Crazy. Can I just, before we dive into, you seem to have a career of surviving and thriving in downturns, or, you know, re-emerging and building successful businesses. Correct me if I'm wrong. Because I cut my teeth recruiting kind of contributor level sales, you know, junior and mid-level sales people as well. And it seems that mortgage kind of advisors and financial planners, these are roles with low base salaries, which means, you know, your fee isn't that high, which means it's quite a grind to kind of like get the volume to do your numbers. Is that the case, or am I misunderstanding?
No, certainly where we started, and you're right, mortgage advisors, they are commission laden, so a commission incentivized, so base salaries that we'd earn our income off was meant that we were deal makers rather than, you know, sort of headhunters. We'd be doing 15, 20 deals every single month. You know, average fee values would have been 2.5 to 3K. As the business developed and became more recognized in the niche, so that would have been sort of, let's say, 2001 through to 2003. Mm-hmm. But we certainly moved into a full spectrum supplier right across the remit of the mortgage world. So it would have moved us into underwriting, business development, processing, the executive teams and the management teams that would sit within that. So we enhanced the fee opportunity over the course of time in that space.
Fantastic. All right. Now that makes total sense. So then what happened after the crisis in 2008? Did you guys carry on trading, or like, how does WRS fit into the picture?
Yeah. So this was, I guess at a time, Q1 2008, and already the wheels were starting to spin. Listen, we were very fortunate. My dad was an official receiver, so he dealt with bankruptcies and insolvencies. And, you know, his piece of advice to me was cash is king and always will be. And I guess because of that, as much as I say it was a lifestyle business, we made sure that the business was well capitalized in terms of working capital. It wasn't a, you know, strip as much cash out as we possibly can. There was reserves in there that meant we had some breathing space to plan. And it was April 2008. And, you know, we kept going. There's always, when the world starts to crash, that there's an element of denial that this can't be happening. The world that we know can't suddenly be disappearing. So we diversified slightly into more of the financial planning world. We didn't have candidates. We didn't have particularly clients in that space. It became more mainstream banking and IFAs rather than the mortgage world that we were dealing with. And it was tough, but we made income that meant we were just about washing our face and not eating into the cash reserves. But it was April of 2008 that I met my now co-founder and business partner, a chap called Francis Dunleavy. He was exiting his former position where he had some exposure of international trade, for want of a better word. Construction was really the marketplace that they operated in, but they'd seen an opportunity in the likes of your Middle East, particularly in Dubai, further afield as well, but Dubai being a predominant feature of I guess where his experience had been. You know, good fees, very, very busy. It was an expat marketplace at the time. They needed the skills, and the demand was certainly there. So we had a number of meetings, lots of conversations over the course of a 2-3 month period, and we took the decision that we were going to set up Worldwide Recruitment Solutions, i.e. WRS, and the focus would be ultimately international and emerging marketplaces. That's where we saw the opportunity. We knew absolutely the UK and certainly Europe did not need another recruiter knocking on its door when it's batten down the hatches time. And it was a very, very difficult time. And that was it. So we'd, and Fran's background, again, just to bring a bit of a sort of colour to what he brought to the party for me, was Fran is, had taken a business from five individuals, a failing business at the time in the IT space, and over the course of a 6-7 year period of time, had grown that to 100 heads, very, very profitable, net fee income levels just shy of sort of £10 million. So yeah, I knew he had the track record of doing that. I think by his own admission, you know, running businesses from a sort of CEO and the financial and operational perspective, not necessarily his bag, but that's what I could bring to the party. You know, Fran was brilliant with the people, brilliant at bringing in, training, motivating, exciting a workforce, lighting them up for them to do what they do and do it in an environment that is respectful and ultimately people want to work. So WRS commenced trading, there's a lot of September the 1st here, but September the 1st, 2008, and that was with a team of five individuals, recruiters, so myself and Fran doing the role that we did, and five recruiters. And, you know, we got those guys, again, sold the dream about where we wanted to take the business, because day one was very much about building shareholder value with an exit, very much on our minds. And that, I guess, was the step change for me, having come out of a lifestyle business into, you know, I guess something with a bit more of a game and an objective and an end game that's at the end of it.
Amazing. So exactly 8 years after you founded the first business, that's funny. So before we dive into that story, which is what we're going to spend the majority of the time on, because you've built an extraordinary business and, you know, I'm sure there's lots of challenges that you had to overcome in the process. I wanted just to make sure people had recognized that golden nugget of information that you shared earlier, which was keeping cash reserves, not stripping out all the profit. And that meant you, you know, could weather the storm in 2008. And it took me a long, long time to figure that one out, Mark. Like so many years where I would spend, you know, the VAT, you know, or the NI bill before, and then it comes due on a quarterly basis and it's, oh shit, yeah. Where am I going to get the money from? And so my accountant recommended a book called Profit First by Michael, I don't know if I'm going to say his last name correctly, Mike Michalowicz or something like that. Anyway, if people search for Profit First, but the idea was you set up different bank accounts for your, you know, tax and your payroll and, you know, all this, but also that you identify the percentage that you want to have left as profit at the end of the year. And instead of, you know, the profit is whatever's left over at the end of the trading year, you actually set that aside as you go along and into a separate account so that you definitely don't spend that money and you do have a profit at the end, but that takes real discipline. How did, like, what systems did you have in place to make sure that you didn't just, you know, take dividends and, you know, for the full amount of the operating profit?
Yeah. Well, when you talk about systems back then, Mark, there wasn't any systems. I mean, the reality was, this was a decision that I'd taken on the back of good advice. And, you know, I think the advice I was given, aside from cash is king, is make sure you've always got a minimum of 6 and ideally 9 months worth of working capital, business as usual working capital, that you can keep the lights on. And if there was a ratio that you were, you know, sort of looking at, that was the ratio that I was given. So that was very much the target of the business. We did have more than that in, and again, that probably supports the fact it was that lifestyle element. And actually, okay, the cash was in the business bank, largely on the basis that it wasn't needed in a social context ultimately.
Fantastic. Great. That's such a fantastic discipline to have that 6 to 12 months operating capital in reserve. I did a poll on LinkedIn recently to find out what fee percentage recruiters charge, and it confirmed what I'd learned from speaking with so many recruiters every day. The majority of recruiters are undervaluing their service and cutting their fees to become more competitive. Listen, if you want to protect your cash flow and build reserves to protect your business against whatever might happen in the future, you need to be earning more for each placement, not less. The challenge, of course, is how to increase your fees and still be competitive. iIntro has helped hundreds of recruiters to make small but critical adjustments to the way they pitch and win business so they can win more clients who are also willing to pay higher fees. For example, one of their clients typically earned £5,000 per placement, but just a few weeks after working with iIntro, she won a new piece of business on a retainer, so in other words, she got a deposit, and her fee was an incredible £20,000, four times her average. If you'd like to see how iIntro can help you to grow your recruitment business and increase your average fees, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained and book a free consultation. There's no obligation, and if you mention that you're a listener of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, iIntro have pledged to offer you a 25% discount off any of their services. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained to get started. September 1st, 2008, you have this vision of creating a global recruitment business. Now, did you, you know, focus on growing in emerging markets? And was the energy sector the kind of vertical that you were going after, or how did it evolve?
Yeah, so we started with two sectors. I could almost say there's actually three, and it doesn't necessarily follow a common theme. We identified that South Africa was a busy market. The rand and the exchange rate was in our favor at the time. Certainly, if I said it's gone double in the other way, so that was a factor for us. And yeah, oil and gas was certainly a marketplace, and so was construction. Now, construction for us turned into a bit of a red herring 9 months in, largely on the back that Dubai was facing significant challenges at the time, caused by the GFC. And we slowly scaled that back down. We started with, again, five people, so each individual had their own specific discipline in a specific sector with a specific geographical focus, and it was no more complex than that.
All right, awesome. And by the way, GFC, global financial crisis, not everyone uses that term, so I thought I would just clarify that. So did you start in day one with five people, or you built? Okay, awesome. So and what was your vision going in? Like, was it intention to really scale, make a scalable business from the beginning, or?
Yeah, we certainly had the appetite to it. It was going to be organic growth. So the speed of scale and growth was going to be determined by our success. And year one was, and the vision, sorry, to go back to the vision, was to grow headcount. So we were very much thinking about headcount, because headcount would have a net fee income number that we would expect over a particular period of time. And that's how we built the model. And we had eyes on 100 individuals that would drive the appropriate net fee income on a monthly basis that would deliver us an annual output of X. And as I say, it was very, very simplistic, Mark.
Well, it's simple, but it's effective at the same time. So I want to ask you about this, actually, since you brought it up, because first of all, how did you arrive at a 100-person business?
Oh, that was our stretch ambitious goal. You know, when you're okay. When you start day one with a working capital fund that we had available to us, to go from 5 to 100 people, you know, that felt like almost a 5-year plan in itself. We did know in terms of markets and geographies and how we were going to break each of those particular silo sectors down. Mm-hmm. And again, relatively simple, by discipline, by geography, into contract, into perm, that would be how we'd split and break the markets down. And we could see, you know, if you think of the global marketplace, you know, getting to 100 heads in terms of your market map that you create, probably is only dealing with 6 or 7 countries, if I'm being perfectly honest. Obviously, the States being a part of that, and you know, some of those bigger terrains where oil and gas activity was taking place. So that was how we set the business up. That was the vision that we had. And as I say, pinning that $120K per month per consultant, you could see the net fee income number that we were driving towards.
Fantastic. Amazing. So, like, what was the kind of roadmap from there, or the key milestones between, you know, 2008 and then where we are today, 2022? I imagine it wasn't straightforward. What were, like, if you look back at, like, the defining moments in that process, what would you say were the key ones?
Yeah, the first key moment would have been 2011, when we were successfully accepted onto a global framework with one of the major oil and gas operators. That was headed up by an individual who's still with me and now a valued member of my senior management team. And that gave us the opportunity, and such was our success within that opportunity. And this was placing drilling personnel at the time who were in high, high, high demand in the oil and gas sector. You know, unbelievable day rates, $2,500 a day these guys were getting paid. Yeah, we were obviously on a margin play, but we effectively grew that account to a level that it really did become a bit of a cash cow for the business to allow us to reinvest. And that situation, or that contract, if you like, really fueled a lot of the investments and decisions that we made for a 4 or 5 year period, right through until sort of end of 2014, when we experienced the oil crash, which took us back into not quite GFC spaces. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was it brought a headwind that you know, we should have known about. You know, it's a cyclic world that we live in. It's a commoditized industry, but as I say, our planning and thinking entering into 2014 was certainly not that this is all going to you know, head into effectively a sector and industry recession when we turn out the year.
Amazing. So 2013, you won this framework agreement, which allowed you to have, you know, a lot of high value contractors working, and that gives you the ability to plan and to grow. What was the size of the business in terms of headcount at that stage?
Yeah, so it was actually 2011 when we won that contract. Yeah, it would have monetized and built up over the course of that 2 year period. Headcount at that time would have been about 30.
Okay, wow. So you went from 5 people to 30 within a couple of years, 2-3 years.
We did. Yeah.
All right. So look, that in itself is very, very challenging. What advice would you have for, say, a business owner who's at the stage you were when you started? They've maybe got a handful of people. It's a small team, 5-6 people, and they have in their sights, same as you, like they want to scale, they want to grow. But like the next step for them is, well, let's get to 30 people. What was the most challenging aspect of about that?
We were fortunate, Mark. I mean, I guess we made our own luck. We actually started, and I guess this is the critical, the critical element that allowed us to scale at the pace that we did, in that we had our 4 heads of our silo or vertical sectors or vertical marketplaces, because the five that we started with, that was always the remit for those guys, that they would be, you know, in almost that Jack and the Beanstalk type effect. They'd be billing consultants, then billing managers, then there'd be, you know, team leaders, and then there'd be the divisional managers, and literally the headcount came underneath them. So we had the ability through the organizational structure to be able to bring individuals in who would have that line manager. So if you sort of sat there with five people today, you know, your biggest challenge is always going to be who's going to be responsible. You know, if we were a rookie recruitment business, that was the world that we lived in. So we always recruited trainees. We didn't go out to the recruitment market on the basis that we wanted a certain DNA. It's enthusiasm, it's attitude, it's all those key traits that you're looking for in a recruiter. We had our own way of doing it. We created a training platform, which I have to say at that particular time was delivered almost exclusively by Fran. But we had confidence in our ability to give people and train people the skills to do the job and be recruiters. And that time to competence, okay, it may have been 0 to 6 months, but what we actually found is that our retention and churn of individuals leaving the business was... I think at one point around that time, Mark, we had 99+ 90% retention for staff.
Wow, it's incredible. Because I would say, you know, normal would be if you can keep one out of three, then you're doing pretty well. Some companies are obviously a lot worse than that, and some would be slightly better. But to get 90% retention, that's maybe, let's put a pin in that, because there's that you must be doing something special there to get that. There was another question though that came up for me when you were talking about you had these five original key team members and they grew into bigger roles, and so you were able to build teams underneath them. Had you recruited people who you saw had leadership potential? Like, was that in the plan from the beginning?
Yeah, it certainly was. And again, you know, if you ask me the question, are all those five people, have they seen the journey through to date? We've got only one of those individuals left. So, you know, that can be a double-edged sword. Certainly at the time, they had the skill set to mentor, to train, to nurture individuals and to take them through that, you know, sort of zero knowledge through to passing probation and actually starting to get a return on investment in that second half of the year. They absolutely had the skills for that and were very, very competent at it. And that's, again, what allowed us to go from the 5 to 30. As I say, the other edge of that sword, you know, we can talk about the learning always is retained about what would we have ultimately done differently. You know, I think it's about taking people on the learning journey, which, you know, we'd have to put our hands in the air, Mark, and say, you know, did we give them the absolute runway for their skills to grow into the next phase of management and the next phase of leadership and so on and so forth? You know, we'd probably have to look at that and say the support levels weren't necessarily as robust as they needed to be to take them through that next phase from, you know, divisional manager, divisional leaders, you know, right through to, as I say, the next level for those guys.
Interesting. Good self-assessment there and analyzing what, you know, what's going well, what can we do better? What changes did you subsequently make in order to address that?
Yeah, so we bought, well, there was two things we did. We recruited our first learning and development manager, or head of, for want of a better word, and it was their responsibility to own the whole L&D framework for us, which included, yes, the recruitment side of it, but very much then about managers and taking them through from that management through to sort of executive or junior board level would be probably the best way to prescribe it. And also to dovetail that with some external learnings and make sure that we're bringing in, you know, the knowledge gaps that we don't necessarily have internally, that we are looking to the outside world to bring the appropriate skills and training in into the business.
Fantastic. That's awesome. So about the retention then, why do you think your retention was so good?
I think I think one portion of it can absolutely be related to the fact that we took graduates, we took individuals who'd never done recruitment, and we'd taken them on the journey, we'd invested in them. I guess we delivered on everything that we said from day one. So we were true to our, and we always approach any recruitment as 50-50. So 50% of the ownership sits with the employee, and absolutely 50% sits with WRS. And their 50% is attitude, enthusiasm, commitment, the want to learn, be the sponge, you know, get on that upward trajectory through your learning and through your performance and your outputs. And I tend to find if we get that 50-50 contribution and both parties are doing what we've agreed to and set out as the charter from day one, you have a happy marriage. And, you know, we were good at that. We were true to our word. We had a respectful environment. We did empower the guys. You know, they had a very clear career path. There was no glass ceiling. You know, we were going for the globe, and we were, you know, the market opportunity for us was endless. And as I say, working with them and making sure the communication is right, that we are, you know, because things change for individuals, and what may have been, you know, fit for them 2 or 3 years ago, you know, whether they've had kids, whether they're in a relationship now that they weren't, you know, then the needs and what they want out of it do change, and keeping a finger on the pulse as to, you know, what those changes are and making sure that we're keeping them on track. And we're on track ultimately, and they're keeping us on track. It's absolutely critical. But we did find that our commitment to the guys and the doing what we said very much bred a loyalty factor that, it's immeasurable. It delivered us 90% retention.
That's incredible. So, Mark, what was the, you said, you talked about communication and about being aware of the needs, the changing needs of your team members and what was most important to them, what their motivators were, and then, you know, fine tuning their goals and plans accordingly. What was the mechanism for achieving that level of insight into each individual in the team and making sure that that conversation was happening?
Yeah, well, I guess this is as your business transitions from being, you know, a small business where perhaps your infrastructure, your processes and your procedures don't support volumes of heads. It's fit for purpose when it's, you know, up to 30. But as you start to make that step change into the wider numbers, you know, systems, procedures, processes, setting out those management frameworks, be it performance management and or, to your point, making sure those touch points are there. So it'd be weekly one-to-ones, it would be your team meetings, and it would be those formal platforms that you know, our consultants and employees would you know, have that time with the appropriate line manager to be able to communicate. You know, and it was very much approached as two-way communication, and that's always been that classic open door policy, if you like, Mark, is something that we've always promoted.
Beautiful, I love it. All right, so then you had wobble, the oil crash. So what happened then?
That was a case of diversification. Again, having the learn of 2007, not so much fresh in the mind, but you don't forget those. You certainly don't forget those moments. It was to move quickly, not sit in, you know, that disbelieving moment where you want to bury your head in the sand. It was happening. There was going to be challenges. There needed to be diversification. We needed to redeploy headcount, which again brought its challenges because, you know, experienced recruiters in a particular sector who are experts in that sector, there's a lot of resistance to moving into sort of fresh markets and everything that means to them. and the desk. But they were the decisions that had to be made. So it was diversification, and it was cutting the cloth accordingly in terms of redeployment of headcount.
Great. No, it makes total sense. I think you absolutely right in terms of like reacting quickly. That's what I did not do in the 2008 crash, which then when COVID came around and had been through that before, I knew I didn't panic or bury my head in the sand like I did the first time. I knew I had to pivot, to use an overused word, and change the way we were working and our marketing and our how we were packaging, and delivering our services and everything. So whereas the first time it was, you mentioned the denial, it was definitely, there was almost a grieving process in 2008, which was like, denial, anger, all those emotions before far too late, actually taking positive action to make something happen. So that was my learn, and therefore the pandemic was much less of an impact. So for you guys, you had to diversify, get people working in different markets, and how did things progress from there?
Yeah, good. And the diversification markets was certainly one of those, but also it was looking at the service proposition. So again, that step away from, that body shopping, commoditized recruitment of just placing bodies. It was really to look at how we could start to add value and mm-hmm. capture more robust business over and above having to, continually be on the hamster wheel. So for us in 2015, that looked like developing a managed service proposition in one of mm-hmm. our vertical sectors, which was very much the offshore space, which supports ship owners effectively. And managed services to us at that time meant that rather than placing ad hoc work, i.e. individuals to work on vessels, we were actually successful in pitching through a tender process for there was actually three vessels at the time, but it was a 3-year contract that had a total of 250 heads as a headcount. So that became a residual income play for us. Now, it meant the service prop had to change completely because we were now responsible for immigration, for global mobility. So when we place an individual onto a project anywhere in the world, we were then responsible for the compliant onboarding, certification checks, so on and so forth, the mobilization and the demobilization, and ensuring as well that we had the appropriate insurances that provided the protection for both the contractor and ultimately the comfort to the client that if anything did go wrong, that we were able to repatriate those individuals back to the designated place, whether that be home or the nearest shoreline or whatever it may be. So it was understanding the requirements within that tender and the contract. We knew that we could deliver on it from a personnel perspective, but it meant that we had to bolt on two or three additional steps within the full service offering to be able to present that as what we term as a managed service.
Very interesting. That's so cool. So actually, I've had a guest on the podcast before, Mark, called Lisa Dixon, and she specialize in helping recruitment consultancies to design, develop, sell, and deliver either an RPO and or an MSP product, and to have more solutions to offer to clients rather than just this transactional, you give us a job, we fill the job kind of thing. But you were quite early to that. So this is what, 2015, did you say? Or?
Yeah, so this was 2015. Again, it would have been the back end of 2015 that we were awarded the tender, but it had been kicked around the management team at that time. which had evolved to be a recognised board. We'd brought on a non-executive director at this point. Headcount turning out of 14 into 15 was circa 120 recruiters.
Wow.
And yeah, we knew that not just brought on by the oil crash, but it was certainly one of those bolt upright moments when, you know, what value were WRS really adding to clients? And it was at that point, you know, we knew that transition from what WRS was as a service prop to where we ultimately wanted to get it, and what was needed and what was desired by the clients in the marketplace, what clients were crying out for, really was this, I think to your point, that value added supplier rather than just that commoditized recruitment business. So we knew what we wanted to do. It was then about planning and putting the appropriate steps and actions in place so that we delivered that. And we got there, as I say, back end of 2015. And that gave us then sort of the confidence and the contract and the proof of concept from our perspective, really to grow, develop that and take it to market.
Amazing. So looking back from the point today, you have offices in multiple countries, £56 million in revenue, and have won like Best Place to Work, Virgin Fast Track, Queen's Award for Enterprise. Apart from the things you've already mentioned, were there any other kind of significant challenges that you had to address in order to get to where you are now?
Making sure the infrastructure was fit for scale. Again, yeah, I suppose our business at that time, we had one recruitment system that was pinned to a server here at the UK HQ where most of the critical mass was. Suddenly you start to grow offices overseas and all of a sudden, yeah, the user experience becomes very, very challenging for these individuals. Technology was moving at a rapid rate, and that has increased significantly naturally during, you know, COVID and the whole digitization program and digital transformation. We've gone through that journey, and we've gone through it relatively recently, as recent as sort of 2020 turning into 21. But it's making sure, from being a one office location, if you're going to be multiple locations across multiple geographies, you've got to make sure that the infrastructure is fit for purpose and it's fit for scale. Because otherwise,
can you elaborate on that then, Mark? When you say infrastructure, you mentioned obviously the software platform, but what are the other elements that you had to change or add?
Well, we have created quite a unique tech stack now, whereby the objective was always about if we win more work, caveat the fact it's you may need more recruiters because it's there's an equation and formula, X recruiters can deliver X output, but actually in some of the contract space that we work with, we're very much a vehicle for clients to enter geographies. So they won't want to be the employer effectively. They've got no particular designs on setting up locations and going through the whole company formation piece. So they'll turn to businesses such as WRS, who can effectively become the outsourced partner to deliver and be that vehicle for them to conduct activities in country. So it was about building the appropriate partner network, about driving automation into the business, and that automation is about business process improvement, essentially. So whereas historically we'd have been thinking about human capital to do the heavy lifting and do a lot of the administration work, we've very much got ourselves to a position now where actually a lot of those processes and procedures are automated, and therefore we don't need to be thinking about human capital unless it is actual increased recruitment work or increased recruitment assignments for a project that we need to deliver on. And I would suggest the outcome of that has been an estimate about 35% of our manual administrative tasks have now been automated. And the seamless flow from system through the integration from front office, middle office to back office has driven significant efficiency gains.
Amazing. So can you give me an example of what sort of thing you would have automated that in the past would have been done manually?
Yeah, sure. So if you could imagine, let's take a placement of a contractor. Mm-hmm. So a contractor is placed, you need to send out a contract. That's usually to be printed out, scanned onto a PDF document. The PDF document then needs to be emailed. It then comes back to you. You've got to print it out. You've got to double sign it. You've then got to scan it again to send it back to the actual. So you know, there's one process which is now automated through digital signing. It drops straight into the CRM system when it returns in, and therefore the manual intervention is minimal. If we then move on to when they're actually out on assignment, our timesheet middle office system is all a digital approval system. So contractor logs in, he'll log his timesheet. The client will then be notified. They log in, approve the timesheet hours. That then flows directly into our mid-office pay and bill system, which then flows directly into the account system for invoicing, so that we don't have any human intervention at all or human requirement through that process. And if you could imagine pre having those systems automated, you'd have been talking potentially about, you know, maybe half an hour to an hour of somebody's time to actually across different departments to actually get to that outcome.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's so cool. I can see why that was a significant. So whose job is that? Like, is there someone internally who drives those process improvements and constantly looks at your systems, your processes, and how we can automate and or, you know, create efficiency, operational efficiency?
Yeah, well, we don't have that skill set internally. We have the think tank, if you like, about what we would love to automate, where we feel the pain points, where we're getting the bottlenecks. We engaged an external consultant who's, you know, old hat, very experienced. It's a company called Worker. W-O-R-K-R. And there's a chap there called Eve. His surname has just left my brain. But yeah, I mean, he was hugely informative. He worked with us on understanding processes, how what we wanted to do, what we were doing, what we ultimately wanted to do, what the opportunity was. And he just brought it to life for us, made the system recommendations, helped us with the integrations and the implementation of it. Because again, we didn't have the knowledge, and I guess ultimately, Mark, we didn't have the time, because business as usual is still very much going on. So yeah, there was a cost there, but the actual, you know, opportunity cost of not doing that would have meant we'd have probably ended up with a system, lots of different systems that don't talk to each other, and we'd have been, you know, back to square one with no benefit. So yeah, employing that, bringing that external knowledge in through that consultant was paid for itself in spades.
Interesting. Wow, that's so cool. I'm really fascinated by that. Excuse me. So why now? Much as we've talked about automation and MSPs and, you know, all this kind of stuff, ultimately this is still a people-driven business, and, you know, you're the people who do the deals and generate the fee income are still at the heart of, you know, of running a successful recruiting business. Why do you think you won best, like one of the best Sunday Times best small companies to work for? Like, what are the things you've put in place in order to create that environment that you're able to attract, retain, and, you know, have people that are highly engaged working at WRS?
Yeah, well, I think ultimately the culture hasn't changed. So processes might have been defined or refined. Processes may have changed. We're brought ISO in, and that brings certain obligations that we have through 9001. But actually sitting behind all that, the management team, the learning and development team, and the culture of the business has never shifted a dial, because, and I refer back to, you know, respect, a fair environment, an environment where people feel they belong, feel they have a voice, feel they have input, they understand the purpose of the company, the direction of travel. And that's through constant communication, whether it's CEO forums. We have a weekly comms every Friday where we talk about, you know, all the great and good that's happened individually in teams. So, yeah, look, to your point, recruitment, whether it's 20 years ago or today, you know, people want to be in a respectful environment where they've got career opportunity and they understand their direction of travel and what contribution that they can make and the pathway to advancement, if indeed that is what people are looking for.
Awesome. You've said this several times, a theme where you've said it's a respectful environment. That's obviously important to you. What does that mean at WRS?
It means that people, I suppose for us, it's a diverse workforce that we have first and foremost. I think respect for me is about being fair. It's about agreeing, i.e. not being a dictatorial business. We may, as a management team, have, you know, budgets to achieve, and that doesn't change. But actually getting the agreement and working with the consultants and or any employee who is performing a task, be it recruitment related or otherwise, that they are communicated to in a respectful way that isn't, you know, one of do. This is about collaboration. It's about a team ethos. You know, I think, yeah, we've all come across those recruitment environments that are a little bit the other way, shall we say. And we're very conscious of that. So I think it is, without getting, making it sound like the Waltons, it's a caring, you know, camaraderie fueled, team focused, where everybody who comes into the business genuinely has a desire to want to see the person next to them do well. And harnessing that and creating that, for me, starts with the management team having and treating everybody with respect. And, you know, part of that respect is being fair.
Okay, awesome. I love that. You also mentioned these weekly comms where, like, could you walk me through what's the agenda or what's the format of that meeting?
Yeah, sure. So that will be myself, and I tend to focus on more of the generic business side of things. So communication around activities or projects. It's a general business update, if you want to put it that way. Then the divisional managers will each have their own sort of 5 minutes where they'll talk about what's gone on. Who've been the top performers, who's done well, who's gone out of the way and gone the extra mile, any feedback that we may have had. So it really is news by division, and that's what the divisional managers, we have news by HR, and then mine will be more of a generic theme about the business as a whole. But it's really about just keeping everybody tuned in to what's going on within the WRS environment.
Fantastic. Do you know Greg Savage?
I don't know him personally. I know of certainly know of his works from some of the podcasts with you guys, and articles that Greg releases through any number of platforms. So I certainly know of Greg.
The reason I ask is he's got lots of expressions and lots of subjects that he likes to talk about, but one of which I've heard him say is, like, you cannot over communicate with your team members, and people need to understand where you're going, what's happening, how they fit into it. And you can go the other way and not communicate enough, but you almost cannot over communicate. It sounds like you guys are doing a fantastic job with that. What's where do you go from here? What's on the horizon for WRS?
So next it will be twofold. We're an energies business. That's what we very much see ourselves as in terms of from here on. And that's, think of anything under that energy umbrella, be it renewables, be it oil and gas. But for us, it will be about continued expansion through geography. The USA is coming hot onto our radar. We've got an opening planned. We've chosen our landing point as Florida.
Cool.
And the office will open in July or August of this year. So we're doing a lot of work behind the scenes now to get the business ready for that. We've done, Fran, my business partner, has done a great piece of work within our Singapore office, where he's been on secondment for the last 3 years, very much working with his succession plan. So a WRS individual who will take over the reins of Team Singapore and the Singapore budget. And Fran, as I mentioned before, no better person at moving into a startup scenario and taking that from 0 to 100 in terms of headcount. And that is very much the plans that we've got over the next 3 to 5 in the States.
Amazing. All right. Well, I wish you every success with that, Mark. It sounds super exciting. And thank you so much for sharing your journey and the things you've learned along the way. I've really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it myself. Thanks, Mark.